I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. Your time is valuable, so we've edited this episode for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. What a strange summer it's been. As we've talked about before on this show, if you're in commercial agriculture or rely on crops for your main source of food or for your animals' food or for your income, you might be suffering real pain. But for the gardeners who count on a bountiful harvest more to augment your food supply or to shore up supplies for winter, you may be wondering what you can salvage or how you can squeeze the most out of the season we still have. We're joined today by gardening expert and consultant Charlie Nardozzi, who's also the host of the Vermont Garden Journal here on VPR. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Jane.
Rainy day today.
It's typical.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about how you're seeing the rainy weather we've had all year affecting gardens? And I don't mean, you know, big corn crops. We've talked about that. And that's
right,
sort of a different matter and
sure.
A different level of seriousness for people. But for those of us who like our gardens, what has happened this summer?
Well, for those who like lawns and perennial flowers and we're transplanting trees and shrubs, this has been an excellent summer because it's been cool and rainy early and then it rains just kind of continued. It did get kind of dry in August, but as you're seeing right now, it's raining again and it continues to rain. So that's been great for new plants that are trying to get established, for the lushness that you see with a lot of the cottage gardens that are around with those perennial flowers. We've had a great crop of lots of different flowers this year, as long as they didn't get any disease on them. And those continue to go because of this cool rainy weather. And the lawns. I'm officially tired of mowing my lawn twice a week all summer long. So for those folks, this has been a great summer. For other folks who are trying to grow vegetables, for example, or anything that likes the heat and the sun, it's not been a very good year, especially, for example, cantaloupes, melons,
hot peppers,
the corn crop, things of that nature, sweet potatoes. It's been a very slow year. And so what I'm hoping for is that we're going to have a nice warm September that'll keep things moving along before we get a frost, usually in the Champlain Valley, at least it's in October sometime, so that you can get a nice harvest out of these crops. Same thing with warm season flowers that really like a lot of heat. They've been very slow. The pineapple sages, for example, usually are in full bloom this time of year. It's been very slow this year to mature. So that's kind of what happens when you have these weather. You know, if we hearken back to the show last year at this time, we were complaining about the hot, dry weather and lack of rain.
Yeah.
And so it's just every season is a little bit different.
Yeah, which is, I guess, what keeps life interesting, right?
It does, yeah.
Charlie, you mentioned frost, and Peggy in Hartford, New York, has already experienced that.
Oh, wow.
So here's her question. She says, we had a very early frost here in Washington County, New York. Most of my squash vines were decimated, though there are some signs of life. Will my remaining spaghetti squash reach maturity? I have read conflicting opinions on, quote, curing winter squash. Should I be curing those that I've harvested? And if so, how? So a couple questions.
Yeah, so a couple questions. So if the frost was just a light one, which I'm hoping is what she's referring to, maybe just kills some of the leaves or certainly just the top leaves that are highest up on the plant and maybe didn't get on the fruit itself, she's probably going to be okay, meaning that the fruit will continue to mature, especially if it's already kind of hardened a little bit. The spaghetti squash or winter squash, of course, creates that hard shell. So if that's already started and it's got a little bit of frost on it, it's probably going to be all right. So if she can get that to keep growing right until we get to the next possible frost, that would be a good idea. As far as harvesting them goes, you want to cut them, leaving a little bit of the stem before the next frost, certainly before a hard frost. And then you do want to cure them. All the winter squash, if you're going to try to save them through the winter, need to be cured. And actually, it's a couple of things are going on with the curing process. One is it's really helping that shell harden up so they'll last in storage right into the winter. Some of them will last up until late winter, in fact. But also what's happening is that you're getting some of the carbohydrates turning back into sugar. So you get more of a sweet flavor with the flesh. So that's why if you just picked a winter squash and ate it right out of the garden, it may not taste very good. But if you left it in a warm, dry place like a garage or a barn or a shed, somewhere where it's going to be like that for a week or two, then those carbohydrates would change the sugars and the skin will kind of toughen up so it'll store better.
Okay, so that's how you cure it. You leave it in a warm, dry place.
Exactly.
Does it have to be dark? Or
it doesn't
okay?
have to be dark. It can be airy, which is really nice. But the idea is to get 70, 80 degree temperatures, that kind of temperature throughout the day, and dry so it's not getting wet on it.
Okay. You mentioned some of the crops that didn't do very well, but for the first time this year, Charlie, I have had resounding success with onions.
Yay!
Time to harvest them now?
Oh, yes. They should have been harvested a while ago, Jane.
You know, Charlie.
What, do you have kids or something?
Yeah, that, and I am a lazy gardener, so I keep looking at them and thinking, oh, I think those are ready, but I don't really have a place to dry them, so I'll just leave them in the ground.
You can listen to the show for next year when you're growing your onions. So the time to harvest your onions is when about a third of the tops naturally start flopping over, and they'll just naturally kind of flop over. They might still be green, but they start flopping over. Then you harvest the whole crop, and you bring it in again to that hot, dry, airy location. Let them dry. Let the tops really dry down. It may take a couple weeks. And then you cut the tops off, and then you can store them through the winter.
What's your method for drying garlic and onions and other things that you know, come off with a little bit of dirt, and you want to leave them someplace, and you don't want them to just be sitting on the ground? So what do you do?
Well, the first thing is to try to harvest them when the soil is a little bit on the dry side, so they're not going to have a sticky clay, especially if you have clay. The clay sticking to the onions or the garlic, and it makes it a little bit harder to take them off. And the other thing is that put them somewhere where maybe on racks or off the ground a little bit. Some people like to hang them. Mm-hmm. That way you get a better airflow around them. It'll dry up that soil. And then when you're actually cleaning them, which is what you should do with the onions and garlic and shallots, is just take off maybe that outer layer of skin. And when you do that, you'll be taking off some of that dirt too. It's okay to have a little bit of soil when you're putting them into storage, but you don't want really dirty onions or garlic in storage.
No. Yeah.
Of course not.
No. I mean, gosh, what do you take me for, Charlie? I mean, maybe I'm late, but I'm not dirty.
I'm not a dirty gardener.
Karen is on the line with us from East Montpelier. Hi, Karen. Go right ahead.
Hello. I have a backyard full of really beautiful mature spruce trees that are being invaded by mutant spruce balls. That's the only way I know how to
mutant spruce balls.
Yeah, you look at these trees and they're tall, so they're not. I can't easily pull these balls of junk out of the trees, but they look like a beach ball size spruce mutant, and they're doing bad things to the trees. Do you know anything about that?
Okay, it could be. Yeah, there are different kinds of diseases that'll get in there and will form this deformation in the tree itself. Something like a mistletoe is kind of like that too. It's a parasite, and it goes into those trees. And if you're seeing a lot of them, I guess it would be a cause for concern, because they are parasitic, meaning that they're going to suck the juices and suck the sap out of that tree and potentially cause those branches to die. So if you can get up there and prune those out, that would be probably a good idea. Now, if they're mature spruce trees, they might be really big. So you might be able to reach some of them and not all of them. But I think the idea of to try to prune those out, move them out of there so they're not sapping the life out of your spruce tree would probably be a good idea.
Karen, can you do that? Can you actually get up there and prune these mutant spruce balls out?
I'm probably not going to be able to do it unaided. I may need to get somebody with a lift of some sort.
Yeah. If they're trees, I think it would be a good idea to do that.
I will do it. It's exactly the your description fits. So
good.
That's what I'm going to do.
All right. So Karen needs some help. She's in East Montpelier. If anybody has a cherry picker and you want to go help her out with her mutant spruce balls, you can find Karen. If you have a question about something else or you want to offer your services to Karen, 800-639-2211. Eileen emailed us to say, although my pears won't win any prizes for looks or quantity, I do love the taste. My problem is that the tree is probably 20 feet tall, so I can't harvest the pears in the upper reaches. Since my yield is small to begin with, I'd like to know whether I can do anything to increase the yield, particularly on the lower branches. Can I top the tree, cut the main trunk to encourage more branches lower down, or would this kill the tree?
Well, pear trees are unique in the sense that they want to grow vertical. So apple trees, cherry trees, plums, peaches, they all kind of, you can prune those to make more of a vase shape or more open, lower shape to them. But pear trees, almost no matter what you do, they want to go up. So yes, you can top them for sure, and that will stimulate some more branching. But those side branches that form will also want to go up. So it'll be an odd looking tree, and it'll be an ongoing process. The other thing you can do, if it's 20 feet tall, you can buy these extensions that are basically apple or pear pickers. And you'll see actually commercial orchardists might have this. And this is something that extends up just like an extension pruner. And it has a little basket on the end, and you can just put it underneath it and pull whole, and you can just harvest your pears that way. So if you're really loving your pears and you've got a big tree, that might be a better idea as far as ways to get those pears down to a manageable level. You can go up to the pears versus having them come down. But as far as producing more pears, pears have flowers that don't pollinate very easily. So it's nice to have a couple different varieties around. That's really going to help with the pollination of the flowers that are out there, and have some wildflowers and other kinds of plants, even apples around, because they're more attractive to bees, honeybees in particular, than the pear blossoms. And then fertilize it in the spring with some compost, maybe some a balanced organic fertilizer. Putting that around, you should be getting about a foot of new growth a year on your pear tree. And if you're getting less than that, it might be a good idea to put some fertilizer down in the spring. If you're getting more than that, you want to actually cut back on fertilizer because you're putting too much fertility into the soil and you're getting a lot of leaf growth and not a lot of fruit production.
And, you know, maybe you should get in touch with Karen. I don't know where you are, Eileen, but maybe you guys could go in on a lift together and then you can have all of the problems solved.
You can take care of Karen's witch's broom that's up there, little balls.
Yeah, perfect. All right. I've solved all the problems so far.
You're doing very well.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Sarah in Williston. Hi, Sarah. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I'm wondering about Japanese beetle grubs. I've seen a brand new one in the lawn already. Do I spray them now while they're just getting there, or do I wait till spring when they start to ruin the lawn?
No, why wait till the damage is done? This is a great time, actually. With all the rain we have, it's a perfect time to spread beneficial nematodes.
I always wait for that. That's like,
you love that name,
don't
you?
Yes, I love that.
Beneficial nematodes. Not to be confused with
Charlie Nardozzi bingo, you've just hit one of the
beneficial
nematodes.
Right. So for those who don't know about beneficial nematodes, these are microscopic little wireworm-like creatures that come in a sponge or sometimes a powder often, and you mix them up with water and you spray them on the lawn areas around where the Japanese beetles were feeding. So what Japanese beetles do in the summer is that they feed and mate, and they usually do it on everything from roses to hollyhocks to basil, but they'll lay their eggs in lawn areas or undisturbed areas close to where they're feeding. So you don't need to go spraying the backyard if all the Japanese beetles were eating things in the front yard. So you apply those now because all those eggs that were laid this summer have hatched. And this has been a great summer for Japanese beetle grubs to survive.
Really?
Because it's cool and rainy, and that's the exact conditions they like.
That's funny because Sandy and Callis wrote in to say, for the first time in as long as I can remember, I'm enjoying the second blooms on our roses because it seems the Japanese beetle population is far smaller this year. I'd love to hear more about that if it's true. You're sounding...
No, she's absolutely right. I'm talking about the population for next year.
All right. So the beetles themselves are lower, but their grubs are going to come back with a vengeance.
Yes, exactly. So there's been fewer adult beetles because, hearkening back again to last summer, it was hot and dry, which are conditions that do not favor the eggs and the larvae to survive over winter. So that's why we've had fewer adult beetles this year. But the ones that did survive and were out there have been laying eggs en masse, and those eggs and larvae, because it's been cool and rainy and wet, perfect conditions for them to kind of survive this summer and fall and then go through the winter. And potentially next year when we do the show, we'll be talking about how many Japanese beetle adults there are.
It's just a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. But you can break up that cycle by applying the beneficial nematodes now. So now is the best time to do it, early September. Spray those lawn areas, water it in if you're not getting rain within that evening or the next day, and let those little microscopic organisms kind of go in there and parasitize the grubs that have been hatching from all the eggs. If you do that now and then even do it again in the spring, like in May or June, June's probably a better month to do it, then you'll have a better chance of reducing the adult population next year.
All right. Good to know. So I mentioned Sandy and Callis, who says she's seen fewer of the Japanese beetles. She had a couple other questions as well. She says, first, blueberry fruit flies have not been a real problem for me until this year. Any advice on how to best deal with these devastating pests? And second, I was pleased to notice that the worm population seemed to be increasing whenever I would dig in the gardens. But when I mentioned this to another gardener, she said there's a species new to our area called jumping worms. I'd love to hear more about that.
Okay. Yes. So, yes.
Blueberry fruit flies.
Let's do the blueberry fruit.
Okay.
We'll do blueberry fruit flies first. That's the Drosophila.
Can I say that again?
Blueberry fruit flies first. Thank you. That's the Drosophila fly, and that is something that commercial growers of blueberries, fall-bearing raspberries, even cherries, I think, have had problems with this. This is a small little fly, like a fruit fly, lays its egg on the skin and pierces the skin, lays its egg inside, and this little maggot, you might say. Yeah, I know. It starts hatching, and then it tunnels in there and causes the blueberries or the raspberries to just kind of dissolve, either on the bush or after you pick them within a day or so.
Better than in your mouth.
Better than in your mouth. Well, it depends upon what kind of balanced diet you're trying to create for yourself.
That's true. Some grubs are delicious.
Some are delicious. So, yes, and this fruit fly is usually a bigger problem on the later maturing crops. That's why I mentioned the fall raspberries and the blueberries. So the blueberries and raspberries that are maturing now, this is where you're seeing a lot of that kind of damage. There are some sprays, I think, that are out there that you're trying, but really for a home gardener, I would say get some fine mesh netting and put that over the raspberries or over those blueberries. Do it a little earlier in the season next year. It's a little too late to do much about it this year. And hopefully what you'll do is you'll block that fly from getting in there and laying the egg on the actual fruit when it's starting to mature. Your early season crops will probably be okay. So if you want to stick with blueberries that mature earlier, like in July, and maybe early August. Ours had no problem with that at all. But if I go out there now and harvest some of the ones that are the later maturing ones, I see that they're very soft and squishy. And if I peel them open, if you want to do this, peel them open, get a little magnifying glass, you might even see that little worm crawling around in there.
So it's do lovely. You eat them, Charlie? Do you have a balanced diet?
Of course I do. Yes, I do. I am a vegetarian, but I will stray to the other side and eat a worm once in a while.
Are you being serious or are you pulling my leg now?
No, I will eat them.
Well, more to come. We're going to get more secrets from Charlie. Things you that, go. You know, we've been doing this for, what, 10 years now? And every now and then I still learn
you
something
learn
new
something
about
new about
that's
me.
Right.
That's it. And her other part of her question was jumping worms. Yes, the snake worms. Yes, and I know you've talked about this on Vermont Edition and a number of different shows here on VPR. They're doing research at UVM all about the snake worms. This is a new species of worm that is really a concern mostly in the forests. So what it does is it gets into the forest, it eats a lot of the organic matter in the forest floor and prevents a lot of the germination of trees and shrubs and things that deer and other animals would need. So you get when you have a lot of snake worms in a forest, what you end up seeing is a lot of mature trees and just kind of a lot of bare. And it's down in there. So it's causing a problem ecologically out there. As far as earthworms in the garden, though, you might find them there. There is a concern about that. But the earthworms that we normally see, the night crawlers and those kinds, they're actually an imported worm. They're not native to North America. They came with the European settlers. And we've been kind of coexisting with them, and they work fine if you have clay soil and you're working the soil a lot, like in an agricultural situation or a garden. But they are not a native creature out there, and they're eating organic matter that could be used by the plants for growing. So, yes, it's nice to have them in a garden situation to kind of break things up, but you don't want to have an abundance of them, and you certainly don't want to have the snake worms.
So what do you do if you have either an abundance of earthworms or the snake worms?
You turn the soil a little bit more. So that turning, the churning is going to mash them up, shall I say, but expose them so that the birds can get them and other creatures can feed on them.
Today is our late summer, early fall gardening show. Take your pick, depending on how you're trying to think of this particular part of the season. And let's go to Keely calling in from Marlboro. Hi, Keely.
Hi. Hi, Charlie. I have a question about I'm going to plant cover crops in my veggie beds. And a couple of my veggie beds I've let rest over the summer, so there's a lot of clover and mustard and whatnot growing in them. So I want to know, I've heard that it's very beneficial to actually turn the vegetation into the soil. One of my questions is how do I make sure that those roots are not just rerooting as I turn all that vegetation into the soil? And can I turn that vegetation into the soil and then just plant, I'm just doing peas and oats as a cover crop, can I just plant those peas and oats in after I've turned that vegetation in?
So if it's, Keely, if the vegetation is really thick, you're probably going to have to turn it under and then wait a week or two and let it really kind of break down. And that will also give you an indication of how much of it is rerooting too. So how much of that clover, probably not the mustard, but more like the clovers, might reroot. So then you might have to turn it again, or at least turn those pieces over again, chop them up a little bit. And then after a week or two, then you can sow your peas and oats. Now it's getting kind of late to be sowing them. I think Marlboro, you might be okay. It's a little bit warmer there. If you're getting later into September and October, then you're really going to have to go more with a winter rye, winter wheat, because the days get shorter, the soil gets cooler, and those crops grow better in those conditions than the peas and the oats. But if you did it now and you did it and you sowed the peas and oats within the next week or two, I think you'd be okay.
Charlie, go over for us the benefits of a cover crop versus some other kind of putting your garden to bed versus just covering it all with a black sheet and hoping that nothing grows until spring.
I'm done.
Yeah, which is what I want to do.
Cover it up with a black sheet, paint flowers on it, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
That'd be nice, yeah. Okay, so if you have a vegetable garden area, especially if you have a raised bed, and you're not doing no-till, that's a double negative, isn't it?
So if you are tilling,
yes, thank you. That's a better way to say it. If you are tilling your garden still, cover crops are a really good idea because what they'll do is they'll add organic matter to the soil. So that would be when we call them green manures. And they could be things like the peas and the oats and the hairy vetch and buckwheat and all kinds of stuff. And you can sow them in the fall to overwinter to hold the soil in place so it doesn't erode, which is a great thing to do. You really should have something kind of covering your soil at all times, especially clay soil, that really kind of holds it in place and you don't get the erosion and breakdown of that soil. And then those crops will grow slowly in the fall. They kind of go dormant in the winter, start up in early spring, and then you'll till them back under again. And those will be the winter wheat and the winter rye and the hairy vetches that I mentioned earlier. So that builds a lot of organic matter in the soil. It really helps break up that clay soil, makes it usable, adds organic matter to sandy soil so it holds more water, more nutrients, all those good things. So you can do that method. That's one method. If you're a no-till gardener, meaning that you are not tilling, let's get it straight, you can grow these cover crops, but of course you're going to have to turn them over at some point in time. What you could do is put things down like the annual rye or the oats and the peas because they will die in the winter. So they will grow for a little while in the fall. The winter cold will kill them, and in the spring all you'll have is this dead plant material on there. Then you can kind of just loosen up the soil like you normally would in a no-till situation and then plant right in there. So you can do it that way, or you can just use a mulch. You can get a straw mulch, hay mulch you got to be careful with because it's adding weed seeds, but dried grass clippings that were not treated with pesticides, dried leaves, and put those over your beds, chop them up a little bit, put them over your beds, and just have it as a cover all winter long. And then again in the spring, whatever's left there that didn't break down, you can just kind of turn that back under again.
Gently. Don't call it tilling.
Fluff. We'll call it fluff.
Fluff. Okay.
We'll fluff the soil.
But Charlie, you told Keely that she's getting a little bit late in the season to be planting some of the cover crops, at least in my garden, which is in Moncton. I still have tomatoes. I still have cucumbers. I still have husk cherries. I still have broccolini. I obviously haven't harvested my onions, which now I'm feeling really very bad about. But so for me, I mean, this is going to be at least a couple weeks before I'd be ready to do anything. So aren't many gardeners in that position where you're still harvesting?
Right. And so a lot of it goes back to your planning of your garden. So if you had some early crops like beans, for example, they're all done. They were done a month ago. Instead of planting a fall crop in there, which you could do, kale or spinach or lettuce, you decide that bed needs a little building up. So that's when you would go with the cover crops. And you can go with the buckwheat or the peas or the oats or that kind of thing. But if you have long season crops like a tomato or peppers is a great example because mine are coming into their full glory now. I would never want to pull
them
out. Then you'll have to resort more to waiting later in the season, and that's why you'd use the winter wheat or winter rye because that'll germinate in cool soils and grow okay when the soils are cool and the days are really short.
How about my other method, which is in the beds that I kept dormant this year? I'm cover cropping with weeds.
You could do that.
It seems to work well. They're really growing
organic matter. Yeah. Organic matter is organic matter. The key, though, is not to let the weeds set seed.
Yeah, okay.
So back to Keely and her mustard. It's great to have the mustard in there, but if it sets seed, then it means you're going to have that much more mustard next year when you're planting your crops in there. So it's fine to use weeds. Mow them down, knock them down. No, in fact, I have a cover crop right now in a bed I put in. It was in the garlic bed, so I put it in back in late July. It's a huge crop of oats and peas, but they're starting to go to seed now. So I'm going to actually cut it all down and use that material somewhere else in the garden as a mulch and then let it grow back a little bit because it'll do that.
All right. More questions. Helen in South Burlington says, this is the second year that my peony leaves have developed dark purple spots beginning after the blooming period in June. These dark spots have spread to the stalks. Any suggestion on how to prevent this?
Yeah. So peonies will get a number of different foliar diseases. One of them is botrytis blight. And I think that might be what she's referring to, those purple spots on the leaves. And that is really due to the weather. The cool, rainy weather enhances that effect really much more so than hot, dry conditions. So the best thing to do for her is that as those plants start to yellow, which they probably will fairly soon, is to cut them down to the ground, but don't compost those material. Toss that somewhere else where it's not going to come back into the garden. Clean up any of the foliage around the plant, add some compost down there, and then next spring is when you have to be watching for it. So next spring, if we have a cool, rainy spring again, before the flower buds actually open, when they're just starting to form, take a look in there if you see any signs of this spotting, that's when you might want to spray with an organic fungicide, like a Serenade, Bacillus subtilis is one thing that works pretty well. And that'll help prevent it from spreading. It's, once you have the disease, it's hard to stop it, but you can stop it from spreading.
All right. So Bailey in Moncton Ridge says, we seem to have more veggie-eating bugs and worms this summer than ever before. What's the best way to make sure they don't overwinter in the garden?
Ooh, depends on the bugs. So we'll take one that I think a lot of people have a problem with, which is squash bugs. Those are those grayish, brown, little shield-like bugs that you see on squash plants and cucumbers and winter squash pumpkins. And they start from just having a few, and then overnight it seems like the whole colony has exploded because that's kind of how they do it. They will overwinter as adults in the soil and plant debris, weedy areas around your garden. So the best thing for them is to, of course, clean up your garden really well and mow down those weedy areas and maybe even turn the soil, if you're a tilling kind of gardener, turning the soil to expose them because they overwinter as adults. Some beetles overwinter as adults, some overwinter as pupae, some overwinter as different forms, as egg forms. But the key with all of them is nice sanitation, good sanitation, cleaning up the garden well, cleaning up weedy areas, places where they might be able to reinvade your garden next year. That would be the best prevention you can do.
All right. And Mo says, how do I protect grape vines from cold weather winter damage, specifically the cold, dry wind off Lake Champlain?
Yeah. So a lot of it depends upon the varieties you're growing. So if you're growing some varieties that are a little marginal up here, you might want to look at having some kind of wind block or wind shield, like the snow fence kind of thing, but using more of a plastic material or a mesh material that will block that wind from actually hitting those vines. That would probably be the best thing that he could do to make them overwinter. You know, there's certainly.
Or move to Napa Valley.
Or move to Napa Valley. Or grow varieties. Like, we always get a great crop from our Somerset Red seedless grapes. I'm not sure he's growing them for wine, or for fresh eating. Yeah. But these seedless grapes are really nice because they're small, they're seedless, and they're tough as nails. I do nothing to them every year, and they come back with a huge crop every year.
What kind was that? That's my kind of crop.
You like that? Yeah, I'm going to give you some. Somerset Red seedless.
Okay. Somerset Red seedless. But basically, you do want to provide an actual shield from
the wind. So if you're growing some of the vines, some of the vinifera types that are a little more marginal up here, or some of the other seedless grape varieties like the Vanessas and the Canadas that they grow in the Finger Lakes well, but we're a little colder, so we have a hard time with them, putting some kind of shield wind block next to those vines would probably be a good idea.
All right, let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Walden. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jane.
Hey,
Charlie. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear.
Okay, great. I have some questions about potatoes.
Fabulous.
The first question is, you know how there's different varieties, the early, mid, and late. So the question is, does the tuber size and volume increase after the designated time? For example, for the early potatoes, I think it's 55 days to 70 days. After that 70 days, do the potatoes still increase in size and volume until senescence? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, I often cut about in mid-August to early September, I cut the vines back to avoid any late blight that might happen. Should I cover the cut tops where I leave the potatoes in the ground until I harvest them in late October or November?
Okay. So as far as the early, mid, and late season varieties go, yes. So when they get to that 70-day, whatever it is, stage, they pretty much are at the size that they're going to be. That's really the mature size of them. And some years you're going to have bigger sized potatoes than others, usually wet years. Like this year, you might get a larger sized potatoes just because there's been a lot more moisture in the soil. The vines have grown better, and they're going to store more food sources, and that's going to create your potato. So at that point, once it reaches that stage, you can harvest at any point. Even if the vines are still green, you can go ahead and harvest the whole thing because they're really not going to get much bigger. Now, if you have a lot of small ones still coming along for whatever reason, maybe it was a mid or late season variety, then you're probably going to want to leave them in the ground for as long as possible.
And they can wait through a frost?
Yes, they can go through frost. Now, as far as the idea of cutting them back to prevent late blight, that's a great idea, especially if you've had late blight in your area before with tomatoes or potatoes, to cut off all that foliage so that you don't even run the risk of having it. But if anything else sprouts up, if more foliage comes up, which will tend to happen with potatoes if you do it early enough, there's a chance that they will get blight on them too. So you may want to cover them. I would use like a floating row cover or some kind of material like that that's thick enough to probably keep a fungal spore out from blowing in, but also allows the plant to continue to grow. Because if you're cutting them back too early, you're going to cut back on your production too.
All right. Speaking of blight, let's go to Gretchen in Underhill. Hi, Gretchen. Go right ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I love tomatoes and have had for the last several years just a horrible problem with what I believe to be a fungal tomato situation where despite black plastic or we even tried a greenhouse to prevent anything that might be airborne, trellising to have a lot of air around them, cutting off suckers that are lower, we just really have what's now kind of a chronic, I think, fungal problem that affects both the foliage and the fruit, although some resistant, like some that are bred or the seeds that we buy that are for to have some resistance to certain fungus do a little bit better, mm-hmm. like high mowing Roma VF paste or something, you know, might do a little bit better. But I've wondered if there's, and we try to move them, I guess I'm wondering if there's anything I can do in the fall other than disposing as fully as I can of any plant matter and not leaving it in the garden or putting it in our compost that we can do to try to promote healthier tomato plants.
Gretchen, thanks for the call. Charlie, Dr. Charlie, how do we treat a persistent fungal infection that just keeps coming back?
A persistent fungal infection will have to operate.
I hope not.
I hope not, too. No, it sounds like she's doing all the right things. You know, she's cleaning things up. She's taking off the lower branches. She's trying to put mulch underneath them so it doesn't spread. And the blights we're talking about are probably early blight, septoria leaf spot, maybe some bacterial things like bacterial speck will get on the leaves and then just spread throughout the plant. And certainly if you're growing tomatoes and potatoes every year in that garden, you're going to build up the amount of spores that are there to reinfect your plants. So it's good that she tried a greenhouse. That would have been one of my suggestions. Maybe if you still have the greenhouse, I hope you still do, maybe the idea would be to clean out the soil that's in that greenhouse and bring in some fresh soil or a mix of potting soil and compost and keep the greenhouse kind of closed until you actually start gardening there so that there's the chances of it getting infected with disease spores is lessened. That's one possibility. Growing things in containers is another one. That can reduce the amount of disease you're going to get on these plants too. Again, using a mix of potting soil and compost in a nice container, you can grow a lot of different varieties there pretty well. You just have to keep them really well watered. And you are trying some of the resistant varieties. I know Iron Lady, Mountain Magic, Defiant. There's a number of them that are blight tolerant, I would call them. Not so much resistant, but they'll tolerate some blight, but they'll still produce a good crop. I would try to lean towards those and use some of these other techniques. And the other thing is if you can, you talked about moving within the garden, if there's another place on your property to actually put a bed just for tomatoes, maybe start a whole new bed over there and not in where your garden is and see if that makes much of a difference, just kind of getting out of where you normally are gardening.
We have a question from Sarah who says, we have a very large maple tree in our front yard where ants, possibly carpenter, have taken up residence in a large hole in the tree. They have a continuous line going in and out. By the end of the day, there's a pile of sawdust at the base of the tree. How do we get rid of these ants without harming the tree? Are there insecticides that'll do that we could spray in the hole?
Well, yes, certainly there are insecticides that you can spray that will kill the carpenter ants. But the bigger issue is that the carpenter ants are there because there's some rotting that's happening in that old maple tree. And that's what carpenter ants go after is rotting wood as opposed to termites, which will go after any kind of wood. So even if you did spray an insecticide to get in there to remove them, to kill them, chances are they'll kind of come back again. So it probably would be worth talking to an arborist or a tree surgeon, someone who knows about trees, who can come out and look at that specific tree and see what can possibly be done to help that tree live a little bit longer. If it's been there a long time and it still looks like it has a healthy canopy to it, meaning the leaves are opening all the way up to the top, there's not a lot of dead branches, then that's a good sign that the tree is working around whatever's going on with the carpenter ants and it's surviving and hopefully will be there for many more years. But without looking at the tree and understanding that, I wouldn't go ahead and just kill the carpenter ants without kind of looking at the whole situation.
We have a time-sensitive question from Jen in St. Johnsbury who says, we are buying a house and moving in early October. Will it be too late to plant bulbs like tulips?
No, it's actually the perfect time to plant bulbs like tulips. What a great thing to have. Maybe an in-law or someone would like to give you a gift certificate to buy like a huge amount of bulbs that you can plant.
That's a good idea.
Or maybe they'd come plant them for you. That would be even better.
I was going to suggest that they should just sneak in dead of night before they've actually bought the house and plant the bulbs if it was going to be too late.
Oh, yeah, that's another nice idea. But you know, October is the perfect time to plant bulbs, whether it be garlic bulbs, shallot bulbs, tulips, daffodils, any of the spring flowering bulbs. And you have pretty much all month to do it. So if you have to do other things that like move furniture or something, go ahead and do that first. But definitely try to get the bulbs. Buy them now. That's a good idea, is to get a good selection going to a local garden center, because often the garden centers will get their whole supply of bulbs for the season and that'll be it. So if you want to get a nice selection, buy early and then you can just put them in a cool, dark place. Don't forget them, because I know a lot of people will do that. So when you move, once you're in there, then you can pop them into the ground.
All right. Let's go to Lanny in Burlington. Hi, Lanny.
Hi. If you get blighted plants and you don't put them in your compost, can you send them off to the state compost, like the Chittenden County compost and that sort of thing?
Well, if it's just like the early blights and the septoria leaf spots, the ones I've mentioned, you probably can, because what they're going to do is they're going to compost them at a high temperature level, and that will kill a lot of those disease spores. Unless you're really into composting and you're doing that in your own backyard, most people just kind of pile the stuff and it eventually breaks down. So you never get those warm temperatures that'll kill them. The exception, of course, is late blight. That is something that I would not try to ship off anywhere because chances are it may not break down in that composting process, and it might be an issue that you're spreading it around.
How do you know the difference?
You can take a look at the leaves. You can go online and see lots of different photos. You could send it up to the University of Vermont, the Plant Diagnostic Lab, and they'll let you know if it's a late blight or an early blight, or something to be really concerned with. Usually late blight is obvious because it's kind of like these water-soaked spots on the plant. It spreads really quickly, kills the plant really quickly, and versus some of these other blights, which are much more of a slow kind of grind throughout the season, as you well know.
Yes, I just always hope that I can get some tomatoes before the early blight fully takes over. We have another frost question. Brooke says, I live in Ripton and we had a light frost and some of my basil leaves have brown spots. I'm curious if I should just go on and cut it all down or if you think it'll have a chance, or at least some of it, to survive. Also, I planted cherry tomatoes a bit late and they're just about ready. Picked two this morning, but the rest are green. Do you think they still have time?
Yes, I think so. I'm have my fingers crossed for a warm September, even up in Ripton. So if that could happen, even if you can get another week or two out of the season up there, that will help. So with the basil, I would just snip off those frosted leaves, the ones that have a little bit of damage on them, and let the ones lower down kind of fill back out. And again, as soon as it starts having threats of frost, you know, basil is one of those crops that doesn't even like temperatures in the 40s. So you might even want to cover those with a floating row cover of some type. There are some that'll protect plants down below freezing. That might be a nice thing to do even right now before the frost so that it stays warm right around the plant. And the same thing with the cherry tomato. The floating row cover are big enough you can drape them over the plants so that it'll help mature those fruits so you can enjoy them and not have a lot of green tomatoes come September.
Isaac is on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Isaac. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have a question about fungal inoculants. I have a fungal inoculant that includes a species that is used for as a fungicide. It's a trichoderma. And I was wondering if that's not a good thing to put in the garden. I was actually thinking about putting it in with the cover crops.
Huh. Yeah, I don't, unless you have a specific fungus that you're trying to kill or there's certain problems kind of ongoing in the garden, I wouldn't just necessarily inoculate soil with some of these types of things. It's always best to kind of look at it in terms of there's a problem here and whatever you're going to spray, whether it be a chemical or an organic spray, any kind of biological spray, that really should be the last resort for what's going on. You really should be looking at the soil health and the plant communities that you're growing and trying to build up that kind of strength as opposed to just inoculating areas with something that might kill a fungus, but it might have some other side effects too.
All right, a couple of phlox questions.
Okay.
Stephanie in Burlington says, some of the phlox have powdery mildew, what to do? And Dana in Lindenville says, I'm having the same problem with my phlox. I also have downy mildew on my melons, though. Suggestions?
Well, they got the same phlox props. Maybe they shared them. Who knows? So I think the first one was powdery mildew on the phlox. That's a very common thing on phlox. Phlox, bee balm, lilacs, melons that she mentioned, cucumbers, winter squash, all of these. This time of year, when we start getting those cooler nights and then those warm, dewy mornings, that's perfect conditions for the powdery mildew to develop. The best thing to do is to look for disease-resistant varieties. There's a number of different ones out there. David is the one in the phlox world and all the David knockoffs, you might say, Shortwood and a number of different ones out there. They are all supposedly resistant to powdery mildew. So it'd be best to kind of look for those first. That will combat the disease so you don't have to really deal with it so much. If you have certain varieties that you love and you really want to have them and continue, try to thin them out a little bit so you get better air circulation around the plants. That'll create the conditions that are drier so it won't get it started as well, and mulch around the plant too. The healthier the plant is, the more likely it is to resist the powdery mildew.
We're going to squeeze one in here from Hannah in Washington. Hi, Hannah. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question about raspberries. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I have a raspberry crop planted in about 2006 on a mound system. I live at about 1,700 feet, and I've been fertilizing it regularly. I've had great years of raspberries, red raspberries. I thin them in the spring, and I've had this is the second year of very poor crops. And I wonder whether or not they have a lifespan, whether I can pull them out, and whether or not I can replant new plants on that place, as I live on a hilly place and have no other options of where to put the raspberries.
Yeah, so raspberries do have a lifespan, and what actually cuts down on their production is viruses that spread from wild raspberries by insects. And so after a period of a number of years, you'll start noticing the plants are not growing so well, the crop is less, the berries are crumbly. That's usually a sign it's best to start all over again. So you pull out all those old berries. You can replant in the same location with disease-resistant varieties, and that's really important to do it that way. But if you do, it doesn't sound like you have another option somewhere on the other property. So I would go ahead and do that. If you're okay with waiting a year, you might want to just cover crop that area, build up the soil a little bit, then come back in with raspberries, and hopefully you'll have a really strong crop after that.
Charlie, you and I on this show kind of hop around like a pesky bunny in the garden from one topic to the next, one plant to the next. For somebody like me who just needs, like, I just need to know, what do I do to put my garden to bed? How do I go through the steps? You have help. You're actually having a webinar, and
yes,
we have to wait a month for it, but this will help people like me.
It will, and you should come. It's October 5th, 7 p.m., 7 to 8:30 p.m. It is a webinar, so it can be anywhere
to
sign up for it. And you can do it in your sweats. I will not see what you look like. It's okay. And what I'm doing with this one, it's all about four gardening chores, what to do in the fall. And I'm really having it to be a listener or a participant directed. So you can send me emails about questions just like you do on this show, and I'll incorporate that into the presentation. And we'll have a half-hour Q&A session at the end of it. So if you're interested, you go to gardeningwithcharlie.com. That's my website. And there's a tab that says About Charlie. You click that on, you'll see Fall Gardening Webinar. You click that on, and you'll see all about the information and signing up.
And Charlie, if people don't want to share you, they actually can hire you.
Yes,
right?
They can still do that too. You can just find me at the same place and send me an email. We'll work something out.
Yes, if you want exclusive Charlie time, he is available for special engagements. Charlie Nardozzi is a gardening consultant and host, of course, of VPR's Vermont Garden Journal. We do have a link to his website where you can learn more about that fall webinar on our show page at vpr.net. Charlie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, great being here.